The message today is very simple. One of our favorite stories of the Bible. Every young child has heard this. Most people who are even just barely familiar with the Bible or Christianity or religion know of this story. And so I hope it reinforces your faith, your confidence in God, and mostly your desire to be devoted to Him. I'm going to be talking some about Daniel today. But before I actually get into the chapter and the story I want to deal with, I want to do something that I really enjoy doing from the Bible. You've heard me attempt this through the years. Some of you have never made these connections that I'm going to bring up. But to me, it just brings the Bible more alive. It humanizes the characters of the Bible. It helps you relate to them better when you understand the connections they have with other key people of the Bible. And Daniel, we think of Daniel as this young teenage boy carried off into Babylonian captivity. And other than the three companions of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, we kind of see him as like this lonely figure. He's kind of all isolated. He's kind of on his own. And we don't really see him connected to other people. But it really is important when you think of someone as great and godly, spiritual, almost totally good, like Daniel. So good that many people who believe the Bible make Daniel a made-up character. Because some of them conclude, nobody can be that good. He's better than Joseph, he's better than Job, you know, he's better than all these great people of the Bible. Nobody can be that flawless and blameless. So they say he's kind of a made-up character to symbolize the best of what God wants in his people. Well, I think he's a real person. Christ mentions him, you know, in his ministry. And so I think he's real. But Daniel did not live in a vacuum. He was not taken into Babylonian captivity until he was, some say, 12 to 15, some say 15 to 20, as a young man. Let's make him 15 when he was taken into Babylonian captivity. Now, what does that mean during the first 15 years of his life, and what role did he have? He was one of the Bible calls him one of the princes, one of the people that lived in the palace. He was being trained for great things within the nation of Judah. You know, so he was not just some obscure person taken into captivity. He was recognized as a potential future leader within the nation. So he was being trained, he was being raised, he was being taught, he was being brought up to be a national and spiritual leader within Judah. About 15 years old, he was taken into Babylonian captivity in the first wave. There were three waves. And the most important ones were taken the first wave. And he was in the first wave, so that tells us of his potential importance within Judah. Well, so what does that mean? Well, it means he was taken into captivity in about 605 BC. So let's make him born about 620. Who was king during that time? Let's go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 34. 2 Chronicles chapter 34. These things, if I am able to bring them out correctly and clearly, will be quite interesting, and I think will make quite an impression on you. 2 Chronicles chapter 34, right at the end of Judah's history before they were taken into captivity. The king's name at that time was Josiah. If you know anything about the kings of Judah, Josiah was maybe one of the top three. Some make him the most godly of any king, including David, including Hezekiah, including Asa. You know, those were like the top three or four kings. If you look at the life of Josiah, he may well have been the most godly of all the kings of Judah. And yet he was the king right before the captivity. There were three or four more in the 3 or 4 years leading up to the captivity. In other words, short-term, ungodly, and all that. Josiah was king until 609 BC. They were taken into captivity in 605. So you see a very short period between the end of his life and captivity. And yet he was a godly king, king for 31 years, a long time. Caused a lot of repentance in the nation, caused a lot of reforms, complete revival, complete turnaround for 31 years. And then just 4 years after he died, they became so ungodly and so rebellious and so bad that God sent them into captivity. I mean, just that in itself shows me how quickly you can lose yourself. How quickly a family can lose itself. How quickly a nation can lose itself. How quickly a church can lose itself. And we've seen it. Good, strong, thriving, growing churches. And then, you know, one or two come in for a short period of time and maybe don't do so well. And before you know it, churches turned upside down, scattered to the four winds. Doesn't take long, does it? And that really stood out to me. I had to refresh myself on that. Such a godly king, maybe the godliest, king for so long, did so much good, and in 4 short years after he was gone, captivity. He was 8 years old, it says, when he became king, and he reigned 31 years. Then you go down to verse 3, and it starts going through the early part of his life. In the 8th year of his reign, while he was still young, he began to seek the God of his father David. So he was 16 years old, when maybe we say he had a spiritual conversion. Maybe he had a commitment to God or something like that. He reached an age where he really turned his heart to God at 16 years old. And then the 12th year of his reign, so he's 20 years old. So now he's kind of pretty much a grown man, close to it. So he had the ability and the age and all of that to really start the reforms that were needed. So he starts all the reforms. So this is in the 12th year of his reign. He's 20 years old. It's 628 BC. Why do I bring that date up? If you look in Jeremiah chapter 1, the first couple of verses, Jeremiah starts prophesying in the 13th year of Josiah. Accident? Coincidence? About the same time Jeremiah started his public ministry, Josiah starts these major reforms. To add to that, if you go down to verse 8 of 2 Chronicles 34, now in the 18th year of his reign, so he's 26 years old, it's 622 BC, right about the time Daniel is born. Daniel grows up under this. Daniel grows up under Josiah the king, a godly man, Jeremiah the prophet, a godly man, and then who's the high priest in verse 9? Hilkiah the high priest, and Hilkiah finds probably the autograph, probably the original document of the book of Deuteronomy, the book of the law. That's why it caused such an earthquake within the nation. Hilkiah finds this, brings it to the king, and it causes a great revival. Who's Hilkiah? Well, he's the high priest. Who else is he? Jeremiah chapter 1 and verse 1. He's the father of Jeremiah. All these connections become really important. So you have the three main offices of the nation of Judah. King is Josiah, a godly man. Prophet is Jeremiah, a godly man. High priest is Jeremiah's father, Hilkiah, a godly man. You have all three key positions, all held by very godly men. This is the environment that Daniel grew up in Judah. The position he had meant that he probably grew up in the palace, heavily influenced by these three godly men. The main influence in his life, probably his spiritual training, was Jeremiah. Now, the interesting thing about Jeremiah's life, he probably was about the same age. Some say exactly the same age, some say within a couple of years, the same age as Josiah. So you follow the life of Josiah. Jeremiah started prophesying the 13th year of Josiah's reign. So when Josiah was 21 years old. And Jeremiah would have been about the age that prophets could start prophesying, between 20 and 30 years old. So I think it's safe to say that Jeremiah and Josiah were very close to the same age. Hilkiah, the main influence on Josiah, had constant access to the king. What does that mean? I mean, these aren't conjectures that are too far-fetched at all. I think the real probability is that Jeremiah and Josiah were boyhood companions, friends. Both grew up under the influence of Jeremiah's father, Hilkiah. Jeremiah reached a certain age when Josiah was really exhibiting his kingly authority, and Jeremiah becomes the voice of Josiah. He became the prophet. Jeremiah became the voice of his father, the high priest. So whenever we talk about Daniel, and I know a lot of this because if you study it all out, I won't give you all the scriptures. When Josiah died in 609 BC, Jeremiah wrote a special lamentation in honor of Josiah. They were very close. So these three great men, and they had this young boy Daniel growing up at their feet. And Jeremiah very well may have been his personal rabbi or teacher. So my point is simply this. We jump into the book of Daniel. We go into the first chapter. We see his young men, him and his three companions, not wanting to eat the king's food, but having their own diet. And they ended up better off. We say, what great young men! Where did it come from? It came from Josiah, it came from Hilkiah, and it came from Jeremiah. Those were the three influences, especially Jeremiah, on Daniel. So when you come to the book of Daniel, think of Jeremiah and the influence on Daniel. Then on the other end of Daniel's life, I think one reason I've really been thinking about Daniel this week, some of you say, well, it's because you've been reading and hearing about some of you going on the Daniel plan, of which Leslie is the CEO, by the way, of that. So she's kind of directing some of you on this Daniel plan, which involves diet, but more than diet. And it's good, you know, it's healthy and it has a healthy lifestyle and all that. It has really good things to it. But I think not so much that. I think because my mind has been on Brother Perdue and the idea that living to an old age in good shape. Daniel died at least 90 years old, sometime in his 90s probably. As we're going to find out in chapter 6 of Daniel, which is where the sermon is from, but that'll go fairly quickly because it's just a story and I'll kind of go through it quickly. Most people forget or never did know that Daniel was around 90, 85 to 90 years old when he was thrown into the lion's den. We normally think of him as a young man. No. He was thrown in the lion's den after the Babylonian Empire was overthrown. He was in captivity for 70 years. If he went in there when he was 15, he was at least 85, because it was under the Medes and Persians who conquered Babylon that he was thrown in the lion's den. And he was so well known to King Darius and Cyrus, by the time he was thrown in the lion's den, that it had to be several years into their reign. So I make him around 90 years old when he was thrown into the lion's den. So I think of Brother Perdue, you know, 90 years old, comes here the last Sunday of his life, he in church, closes out the service with a godly prayer, encourages all of us just by being here, and then he goes home to be with the Lord. I mean, what a way to end your life. And that's how Daniel ended his life. The best work of Daniel's life, as great as he was all the way through, was maybe the last 5 or 10 years of his life. The greatest act of faith of his life, and one of the greatest acts of faith of anybody in the Bible or in history, was a 90-year-old man who sat with the lions all night, and he was not couching in the corner in fear, trusting in the Lord. Part of him may be hoping at 90, if they eat me, you know, I'm 90, I get to go be with the Lord. So either way, he was kind of like a winner. On the other end of Daniel's life was Zerubbabel, who brought those 50,000 back to rebuild the temple and rebuild the city of Jerusalem in the book of Ezra. Zerubbabel was probably, what, at least 30 or 40 years old, maybe 50. You know, he was a grown man, well-established, well-respected, to become the leader of that group to rebuild things. That means for 30 or 40 or 50 years, he was under the direct influence of Daniel, and I think the evidence shows that Daniel single-handedly, through his influence with Cyrus, was responsible for that order for them to return and rebuild the temple. It was Daniel that caused it to happen. We know that from Daniel chapter 9, first three verses, that great prayer of repentance he prays. He said, I read in the writings of Jeremiah. Jeremiah wrote letters to the captives. I think probably Jeremiah and Daniel had regular correspondence. I mean, think about that. And Daniel says, I read in the writings of Jeremiah that the captivity in Babylon will be 70 years. Well, the Medes and Persians had just overthrown Babylon. It had been 70 years. All of a sudden, Daniel realizes, hey, the time is here. Daniel 9 is all about praying to God to let it happen. Then all of a sudden, here's Daniel, who is next in power to Darius and Cyrus. All of a sudden, Cyrus issues a decree that the Jews can go back and rebuild their temple and their city. Well, how would he even know they wanted to? How would he even be prompted to issue that decree? Daniel. I mean, Daniel was involved in the highest level of politics of two great empires. That makes him even more than Joseph. Joseph just had Egypt. Daniel had Babylon and the Medo-Persian Empire. And he rose to the highest levels of both. Most of the time when one empire conquered another, you get rid of all the top government officials because you can't trust them. There's something about Daniel that he was beloved and respected and honored in two empires. That's pretty amazing. So let's race through Daniel chapter 6. I just wanted to draw those connections. Yeah, I could go on and on about Zerubbabel's influence then on Mordecai. And Daniel's continuing influence on Mordecai in the book of Esther. This whole line of about, you know, six or eight people over the course of a few hundred years. And Jeremiah is really central to all that. Verse 30 of chapter 5 of Daniel, that very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. You know what I think when I read this verse? This is Babylon, isn't it? That very night, in one day, in one hour. You know, I think of Revelation 17 and 18, when the whole Babylonian system is going to be destroyed in one day, in one hour. Here's the precursor to it. Here's the example back in history of that very thing, the mighty Babylonian Empire, the head of gold of that image, destroyed in one night. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Daniel is at least 85 at this point. It pleased Darius to sit over the kingdom, 120 satraps, governors, divisional rulers to organize the kingdom. And over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them so that the king would suffer no loss. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps. Now, if you're going to pick 120, you're going to pick 120 people you trust. They've proven themselves. And then from those, you're going to pick three that you can really trust to have the skills and the confidence, trustworthiness to be over the whole thing. And then those three would report directly to Darius or Darius and Cyrus. And then of these three, Daniel was the first. So you're just under the ultimate ruler. Then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps. And look at this description. Now, if you can live your life and people are able to say this about you when you're 85, 90 years old, like we were able to do with Brother Perdue, an excellent spirit was found in him. You know, you can't hide that kind of thing at 85 years old. You know, you can't deceive people into thinking you have an excellent spirit, especially in the world of politics. At the highest levels, we see what's going on in our country in the conventions right now, all the behind-the-scenes intrigue and the backstabbing and the pressures of people to say certain things in certain ways is tremendous, even to the point it practically destroys your career, your family, your life, your health. I mean, the pressure at that level is unspeakable. There's all kinds of jealousies, there's envy, there's schemes behind the scene to get your position, to throw you down so you can be... We know how politics are. It's always been the same. World empires are no different. Put yourself in Daniel. You know, we think of him as this real peaceful, content guy who's close to God and all that, and he was. But his daily life was full of tremendous political pressure. Important decisions that if he didn't get it right, he would be killed or imprisoned. I mean, we don't normally think about that part of Daniel's life. But it puts yourself at the highest levels of any political group. And the constant hassle that it is. And yet, in spite of all of that, which would make you bitter, would make you look at things in the most negative way about everybody, he still maintained an excellent spirit. I preached often through the years this idea of, you know, whatever you face in life, it will make you either bitter or better. And those two words are just one letter apart. And it really is that. You go through life, you face what you're facing. Nobody knows all that you're facing. And to you, it's very large, and it probably is pretty large. And you see some people that starts turning them bitter, angry. You see other people, it makes them stronger, better. You think, well, they're not going through what I'm going through. Oh, they might be and more. You just don't know it. Daniel was a eunuch, so he had no wife and children, no family to come to home to, no safety of those who loved him in his home. He was a captive away from his beloved city and land. He was in the highest levels of politics, which is a dark, difficult world to live in. And yet, at the end of his life, he was better and not bitter. And he had more reasons than most anyone to become a bitter person. But he had an excellent spirit. Oh, to get through life. And for people to say about you, you know, they really have a good spirit about them. And I've been blessed, not only with Brother Perdue, but with Brother Harless and Brother Jesse Scott, three great men in my life, that I was able to be their pastors at the end of their life or near the end of their life in Brother Scott's case. And in all three of them, I saw the effect of living a life for the Lord by faith and how they were in their declining years. And each of those three men, the best in them came out. And I knew some of the things that all three of them faced in their life. But I saw this excellent spirit rise to the top of their life at the end. And they all became very similar to the Apostle John in the church of Ephesus. When history says they had to carry him in on a stretcher because he couldn't walk. The last surviving apostle. And he would sit in their services and he'd repeat over and over and over to them what he wrote in 1 John. My little children, love one another. It's all he would say over and over. Because at the end of his life, the most important thing in life rose to the surface. That's Daniel. Such a good spirit in his declining years. And the king thought to set him over the whole realm. So the governors and satraps sought to find some trouble. Here's real politics here. This is not the first time this happened to Daniel. Remember the image? He didn't bow down to it. His three companions, the fiery furnace story. And you know, there are many times that are not recorded that this kind of thing happened in Daniel's life, no doubt. So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful. That's the thing that'll get you to the end in good shape. Be faithful to God. No charge or fault. Nor was there any error or fault found in him. And these people trying to find against him had access to everything about him. They couldn't find anything. And these men said, we shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. Let's use his faithfulness to God, his devotion to God's laws against him. Because even though he was loyal to the leaders of the Babylonian Empire, Nebuchadnezzar and the rest, Belshazzar, then he was loyal to Darius and Cyrus. He was like Peter and John in Acts 5. And they knew this about Daniel. When it really came down to it, the core of him was, we have to obey God rather than man. And so they knew if some way they could set something up that would be a conflict, would he obey the king or would he obey God? Because they knew Daniel would try to do both if possible, and not have any conflict. But they knew if it came down to it, he would choose God over the king. And that's exactly what they did. So these governors, satraps, thronged before the king and said thus to him, King Darius live forever. And now they're going to flatter the king. They're going to appeal to his pride. The king should have been suspicious. But you know, when people flatter you and appeal to your pride, you become blind. And King Darius became blind. The kings of these great empires were considered gods. And so they basically said, have everybody treat you really like a god for 30 days. And if they pray or appeal to any other kind of god other than you, they'll be cast into the lion's den, they'll be punished, because you're really the only one. Well, you know, that just really appealed to his pride. He made him not think clearly. And they told a lie, which almost all appeals to pride involve lies. In verse 7, all the governors of the kingdom and administrators and satraps, the counselors and advisors, have consulted together. Oh, but they probably just by coincidence, just by accident, left one man out of this consultation. Daniel. They've consulted together to establish a royal statute to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. So his ego, his pride blinded him. So he wasn't suspicious of their motives. Now, O king, establish the decree, sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which does not alter. So if the king signs the decree, then the law of the Medes and Persians says that law cannot be changed. But can't the king change the law? Well, no, because if the king really is a god and the king makes the law, then if the king changes the law, he's admitting he was wrong when he signed the law. So you see, it sets it up for the law not to be changed. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree. Now, when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, so he evidently got word of this, or either knew about it and wasn't involved or something. But he knew about the law. He knew it had been signed. He was privy to all of that. It did not change. Here's where the real test, and I probably bring this up more and more in the years ahead. The Lord's people, the Lord's churches, are going to be faced with this situation more and more. Do we obey the human government? Do we obey God? The churches through history faced it daily, were slaughtered by the thousands, had to hide in caves and dens and underground and out in the forest, had to live in the mountains, the Alps of Europe, the Waldensians and all of them, the people of the mountains. They would hide up in these real high up mountain valleys where nobody wanted to go to enforce the laws. They did this for survival because the laws said, you know, certain things that would violate their service to God. And it was such things that made it clear. You're either going to follow the law of the government, which in their mind was the same as God, but it wasn't. Or you're going to follow. And that's why our country was founded so greatly upon the principles of freedom of conscience, soul freedom, freedom to decide for yourself, freedom to worship God after the dictates of your own heart, and that government cannot tell you how you are to serve your God. But that wasn't the case most of history. Most of history was just like the time Daniel lived in. Laws were made, and it would violate your conscience to serve God. And Daniel understood all this. He had a decision to make. He didn't fret. He didn't worry. He didn't question. He didn't take a lot of time to decide like his three companions in the fiery furnace. Lord, King Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to go off and consult. Our mind is already made up. We will not bow down to your image. And they were cast into the fiery furnace. Then Daniel was the same way. He went home in his upper room with his windows open. You say, why didn't he shut his windows at least, try to hide it? Well, I mean, it was just, you'd open up your upper windows for ventilation, let the breeze in. He wanted to see the direction he was praying in toward Jerusalem. And he wasn't going to change anything just for his own safety. In his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Have you ever thought about this verse before? From his early days, his whole life. He's about 90 years old here. He was taken captive at 15, so probably even before 15, but at least for those 75 years in captivity, every day, 3 times a day, not just driving down the road, not just before a meal, saying a quick prayer, stop everything, and he had the most important responsibilities of anybody in the empire other than the king. He probably had a mountain of paperwork, people to deal with, pressures all day long, decisions to make. So you say, well, you know, I don't have the time to do that. Daniel's life is probably much busier than any of us. Yet 3 times a day, he stopped everything, went to his room, opened up the windows open, faced Jerusalem, got his mind off everything, focused totally on prayer, and probably, what do you think? He prayed 30 seconds? I think he prayed 3 minutes? I think it was probably an extended prayer. 3 times a day. You say, well, I pray 3 times a day. Is it the kind of prayer that Daniel prayed? And I want to add something here for your own studies. That chapter 9 I mentioned earlier, keep your finger here and look at chapter 9. When did Daniel read Jeremiah about the captivity being 70 years and he launched into that great prayer of repentance? Look at what it says. In the first year of Darius, the lion's den was probably a few years later. And verse 3, I set my face toward the Lord God. And chapter 6 says toward Jerusalem, the same idea. To make requests by prayer and supplications with fasting, sackcloth, and ashes. And I prayed to the Lord my God. And you read through this great prayer of confession where he says, I have sinned, we have sinned. He's including himself. And he's praying that God would answer the prayer to let them go back and rebuild the temple and rebuild the city. This is the first year of Darius. Chapter 6 is after chapter 9 in chronology. I wonder if the 3 prayers that Daniel prayed every day was this same prayer. This same prayer. And prayed it every day, 3 times a day, until Cyrus issued the decree that they could go back. You read through chapter 9, and that's no topwater prayer. That's a real heartfelt, deep, long kind of prayer. And I think he probably did get in sackcloth and ashes each of the 3 times every day. Now that is serious prayer. And if you want to know the real key to Daniel reaching the end of his life with an excellent spirit and being described as faithful, it's probably Daniel 6 and verse 10. 3 times a day, he stopped everything and focused on God. He focused on prayer. He focused on spiritual things, even though he was away from all of it as far as his homeland. And he did this his whole life, the end of verse 10 addresses. Then these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God, and they went before the king, spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days? So they thought they had him, they trapped him. Except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. The king answered and said, this thing is true, according to the law of Medes and Persians, which does not alter. And they answered and said before the king, that Daniel, that must have been a dagger in Darius's heart. He loved Daniel, respected Daniel, needed Daniel, depended on Daniel. Maybe the only trustworthy man in his entire government system. That Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petition 3 times a day. And the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself. He realized, I let my pride and ego blind me. I should have been suspicious. I should have realized that they were setting me up for something. Because you can never trust when a group of politicians are all in agreement. That's been true all through history. Still true today. Don't trust them when they're all in agreement. That means they're united in wickedness. Is almost always what it means. And he realized that he had been set up for it. He set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored. He's trying to find a, you know, something in that law that he had signed that would let him wiggle himself out, but he couldn't find it. Verse 15, then these men approached the king and said to the king, King, know, king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed. The king gave command. They brought Daniel, cast him into the den of lions. The pictures you see often have maybe 2 or 3 lions. You'll find at the end of the story when all those who set him up, them and their wives and their children, were all cast into the den of lions, and many of them were eaten up and killed before they even reached the bottom. There was a lot of lions, and they were all hungry. They should have jumped on Daniel immediately and torn him to shreds. So the king gave the command. They brought Daniel, cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually. I mean, these great statements about Daniel. An excellent spirit. He was faithful. Your God, whom you serve continually. I mean, but wasn't he doing government business all day long? Yeah, but he did it in a spiritual manner, testifying of the God that he served, even though he was doing a lot of mundane kind of work. Your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. Now think about the influence that Daniel had on Nebuchadnezzar, on Belshazzar, the handwriting on the wall, now on Darius and Cyrus, the greatest dictator rulers of empires, some that the world has ever seen. And they all loved and respected Daniel. What a man. Then a stone was brought and laid down the mouth of the den. The king sealed it with his own signet ring, with the signet of the Lord's, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. The king went to his palace, spent the night fasting. I mean, this is a pretty amazing picture here, that he would do this on behalf of Daniel. No musicians were brought before him. Also, a sleep went from him. Then the king arose very early in the morning, went into haste to the den of lions. When he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. See, his faith wasn't quite the same as Daniel's. His was more hope and wish. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? It seems impossible that that could be the case. Then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. Now, I think he was shocked. Darius, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, shut the lion's mouth so that they have not hurt me because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. Then the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den. No injury whatever was found on him because he believed in his God. And now the story at the end is Haman's story, isn't it? In Esther, hung on his own gallows. The book of Psalms and other places in the Bible often talk about those who scheme and plot for the downfall of others. Often it comes back on them and they're the ones who are destroyed. What a waste of energy especially among God's people, especially among saints, to plot and scheme the harm and destruction of other saints. We've all seen it. We've all seen the effects of it. And we've all seen, it may take a while, God's hand of judgment coming down on that person or those people for their evil schemings. God has a way of getting back. It may take a lifetime. It may take even into eternity. But God will right all wrongs. And the king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives. Boy, that's pretty brutal, isn't it? And the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. Those lions were able to be gluttons that day and were well fed. You talk about justice. Then King Darius wrote, and earlier kings of Babylon wrote the same thing about Daniel's God because of his testimony. To all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. Now, in our way of thinking today, we wouldn't want our leader to issue a command like this, because any command by a human ruler to practice a certain religion and a certain God in a certain way usually ends up in disaster. And it doesn't say Daniel approved of this law. You know, this is just a human king reacting to what he saw, and a human king used to making these kind of decrees. So don't necessarily think it's a good thing that he ordered this for all of his people. But it did make all the people of his empire, his kingdom, aware of the true God. And that's a good thing. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed. It's pretty amazing. You're just a brand new empire having overthrown Babylon, and you say this. And his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues. He works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. Who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lion. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Faith pays off eventually. It may not seem like it at the moment. See, our way of looking at faith is that God should have prevented Daniel from being thrown in the lion's den. But faith might mean you're thrown in the lion's den. You're thrown in the fiery furnace. You actually have to face it and go through it and come out the other side. But faith means in the end, you will be better off because of it than if you had tried to escape it yourself. Like that movie that was made about Esther, some of us watched, One Night with the King, Daniel, One Night with the Lions. And the creator of the lions made sure that the judgment that was intended for Daniel was put onto other people. God's people down through the ages have been mistreated, misaligned, thrown into prison, killed, tortured. But there is coming a judgment day when God will make sure that justice is meted out. And those who have had faith, even to the point of giving their lives, will rise in glory, be with Christ forever. Those of these kind of people who sought to do God's people harm will face their judgment, and it will be very unpleasant. And this real truth of this story that every young child in beginner class can grasp: trust in God and he will take care of you. Put your faith in him, so that the end of your life, you can have an excellent spirit. And still, at the end of your life, have a profound influence on those around you. That's the truth of Daniel chapter 6. And I pray that it will be a reality in our life. As we prepare for a verse of invitation song,